Welcome, welcome, welcome. This is episode 151 of the Distraction Pieces podcast with the one, the legend, Huey Morgan. I love Huey. We get into some great conversation in this. It's kind of a two-part podcast because we recorded them a week apart, but he came on my podcast and then I went on his podcast, which is a Huey Off the Record, which is on iCast and iTunes. Acast and iTunes. It's also on iCast and iTunes. But yeah, it was great. My guesting on his podcast is one of my favourite ever guesting on anyone's podcast. It was an amazing chat. It got pretty deep and heavy. He's a great dude, as this one did. I mean, Huey really opened up in this, and I really appreciate him for it. He's had a book recently called Huey Morgan's A Rebel Heroes, The Renegades of Music and Why We Still Need Them, which is on Amazon and Audible, if you're asking. He's got a lot of stories to tell. He's lived an insane and impressive life, and somehow he's come out the other end as a very intelligent and calm and nice dude, and we get into all of that. So, and he also tells some amazing stories that are needed to be told. And I had to ask him about his appearance on Nevermind the Buzzcocks, because he got angered by Jordan of Rizzlekicks, who I've also had on the podcast and is a mate. So I wanted to get into that. I had to be the impartial, you know, I had to be Sweden or Switzerland, is it? I don't know, whichever one's the impartial one. Yeah, so that was good. But I should mention that we're brought to you by SpeechDevelopmentRecords.com. Speaking of Renegades of Music, everyone on Speech Development Records is a Renegade of Music, so check out all of our stuff there. There's still some signed books left. I signed a load of my book, which Huey kindly talks about and references in this podcast, so that's lovely. So check that out. Also, I'm reckoning it's going to be next week that we launch the summer range. At this stage, the photo shoot will be done, so I can tell you that all going to plan. I'm recording this before it's happened, but all going to plan, we did a guerrilla shoot in all the new merch, which includes a women's swimsuits, guys' swimming shorts, leggings, some sunglasses, which are amazing. They've got, they're kind of unbranded other than the slogan of the label, which is, we may not be for you, and that's fine. I didn't want to plaster them with Scroobius Pip or Speech Film or Records or any of that. It's a pair of sunglasses. You just want them to look cool and discreet. So there's that. And we shot the vests and the caps and all of the summer range. So yeah, man, are we going to be? I said at the time of recording this, I've not shot it yet. But if we can pull it off and not get arrested, if when you're listening to this, I'm in prison, then you'll know why. But yeah, it was a pretty cool shoot, or it looks like it's going to be. I keep talking as if it's happened. It's not happened yet. It's happening in a few days. It looks like a pretty cool shoot. So if I've not blasted those images on social media yet, then they're to come. So make sure you're following at Scroobius Pipio on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook.com/Scroobius Pip. But let's get into this week's podcast, episode 151 with Mr. Huey Morgan.
I mean, it's also, that's your instrument of expression. So if you can't like know where the sweet spot on a mic is,
yeah.
Because when, you know, when you're doing club gigs and stuff like that, sometimes you have to kind of get right up on that thing.
100%. And people will say, oh, this mic is 360. It's like,
It
says it's 360, but still you're going to get all the tone and color if you're going direct in. I've already started rolling in that traditional podcast manner of coming in halfway through a conversation. I'm joined by by Huey Morgan. How you doing, man?
I'm very good, Pip. Thank you for having me on the podcast, man.
I mean, we've been talking about this for ages, so yeah. I'm glad we
literally
finally got
years,
to,
yeah,
bro. Yeah. So, I mean, so it's on. It's beautiful.
And it took me to figure out, listening to you, that I would like to kind of almost do a podcast. So yeah. I'm starting to do a podcast. And what's cool is that you were my business model.
Yeah.
No, when I say business model, I mean it's like that's as good as I'd like to do it because you do this thing really great. And
that's
thank
cool.
you for, thank no. you for taking the time to let me know what you, your setup is and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And we're in basement at the London Edition Hotel,
yeah,
which is
cool place.
A good spot. And again, like one of the things I was saying to you, when we were having a discussion beforehand about podcasts and that, I was things like, it's cool if there's some noise going on in the background, if there's like the bar is being restocked at the moment, there's people working hard earning their wage. That adds atmosphere.
And it's also
right?
really bright in here, too.
Yeah.
It's cool looking, right? The wood. Thank you, Caroline and Ben Pundle.
Yep.
Here at the Edition. It's a cool spot. Now, this was like, you know, if things go according to plan, I can actually do shit here.
Yeah.
This
yeah.
could be like my podcast spot. It's kind of weird, though. It looks like people are going ready for a presentation. It's, but
It's great to have that spot in London that's kind of the base for you. It's kind of, there's a lot of podcasts out and about that, I don't know, if you have to drive out to Essex. Again, if I recorded all mine at my place in Essex, I'd have half the guests.
Yeah.
The fact that you can say, we've got this spot in London, just come down, then it makes it a lot easier.
It's also kind of central. I mean, we're in like right off of Oxford Street, so
yeah.
it's a really cool spot.
Yeah.
And for us, it's great, because I'm out in Somerset, you're out in Essex, so...
It's the middle.
Meet in the middle, baby.
It's the centre point, it's perfect. Yeah. How are you finding it out in Somerset? That seems crazy to me, because you're... From New York, you've lived in London, you've lived in big cities.
Yeah. Well, I also lived in small places. You know, I did live in Dublin for a minute. I lived on Maui for a while as well.
Yeah.
I kind of like the duality of Somerset and New York City. Because I do go to New York City all the time, and my kids love it. My wife used to live there with me as well.
Yeah.
So I think when my son was born, my wife and I were like, we're going from city to city all the time, to the houses, right? And I was like, oh, yeah, it is kind of like boring to the point where don't you want to see something else? And now that you have a kid... You don't want people to see pollution and buses and all 100%. Kinds of shit. And for me, I was growing up in a city. So my wife's family's from out west. So I started looking around out there with her. And we fell in love with this old house. And it's like a big old Georgian manor house.
Amazing.
It's dope, man. And it's a great place to be because you appreciate stuff when you see it.
Yeah.
More, you know?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And it's interesting because we're drawn towards cities because that's where we need to go to hustle to get a foot on the ladder to get involved in somewhere, and it takes you a while often to realize that you're already on that ladder now, and particularly for someone who's it's touring life, it's things like that, it's like it doesn't really matter where your base is because you're not having to be like you don't work in an office, you've not got a city job, so you can kind of be wherever you want because the start point of every tour you're always coming from somewhere.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if you're traveling from Somerset or from London, you're going to somewhere.
You know, I found that especially when I'm not working, I kind of really like being at the country house because it's just, it is what it is. It's more comfortable, it's big, it's airy. You know, it's kind of like on its own land, so everybody can kind of, you know, close the front gates and stuff and everybody can just hang out. And I like that kind of idea because it's almost like my own little neighborhood.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Because I remember when I grew up in the city, there was like my block, man, you know, from one street to the other in Manhattan. It's not too far. But that side of the street was my block. I kind of have that. My kids can kind of have that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And like their friends come over and hang out and stuff. I think it's really cool. And then I can fly to New York and my boy can take the subway.
Yeah.
You know, so
it makes you appreciate this. Cities that bit more. It makes you appreciate London and New York that are both beautiful and insanely condensed and everything you could imagine is there, everything you could need. But when you've been in that for even just over a year, it's like, that's how life is. That's how it is. It should be an exciting thing.
Yeah, I did grow used to living in New York.
Yeah.
I totally did. Because I grew up there and it was everything. And then when I went to the Marines and I came back, it was like, just like it was before, boom. You know, and every time I go to New York, I haven't missed a step.
Yeah.
So you kind of realize that maybe the city's in me, rather than me being in the city.
100%.
And I think that's important. And once you get to a certain point in your life, that becomes apparent, you know. And you do want some relief. And I almost realized that back when I was a kid, I had an uncle who lived in like Mount Kisco, New York, which is like a suburb of New York City.
Yeah.
And I was like, why the fuck you live out here, man?
Yeah,
the fuck's he living out here? And I remember the cool things recently about his house. He had his own den, and he was an Air Force dude, so he had like all this African shit when he flew to Africa and all this all around the world. But his man cave and his the den. He had a stereo. He used to play fucking Led Zeppelin. It was amazing. Cool, right? I was like, that's why he moved the fuck out of the city. Yeah. So he had his own space and his own land, his backyard and a pool and shit. It's like, no.
And dude's still near enough to go into the city when he needs to be in the city.
Yeah, be in an hour and a half, man. No problem. And that's the same thing for me. I'm an hour and a half outside of London.
Yeah.
So for me to come in and do the radio once a week, that's a pleasure.
Yeah, yeah. That's gold. Let's talk about growing up in New York. How was it for you? It's kind of, it's known in the UK at least, it's only known from films. It's tough, it's rough, there's heart and there's character. How was it for you? What end did you fall on? Were you getting in trouble? Were you, you know, what was your deal?
I know that when I grew up there, it is all those things too.
Yeah.
But I've actually, you know, when you get all, you wax nostalgic with people a lot. My wife lived with me in New York while we were married and before we were married.
Yeah.
And she's like, explain New York to me, you know? And it's like, that's the one time I actually went back and started realizing that not everything was fucking amazing.
Yeah.
Not everything was just so awesome. And I was so hard and I was the man.
Yeah.
You realize that the things that, you know, weren't that great when you explain it to someone that you really want to explain it to. And yeah, I grew up in the Lower East Side of Manhattan. In the 70s, right? Mm. So I went to school down there. I did go to school for a minute. In high school, I went to Humanities, which is on the west side in Chelsea.
Yeah.
And, you know, but most of my time was the Lower East Side of Manhattan. And that was great because it was like the best microcosm of New York you could live in.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of dudes that I knew were in Harlem and stuff, but they'd come downtown. You know,
not in Brooklyn,
but they'd come downtown.
Yeah.
And that was just great because it was, you knew that.
So you're the mixing point of all the different areas.
But early on, it's just like any place, like you said, condensed, right?
Yeah.
So we didn't know that there was like abject racism because we had dudes that were mixed up from like an Indian dude and half Indian and half Kenyan.
Yeah.
Right? Dude that was Puerto Rican and Irish, myself, right? You had a dude who was Jewish and Palestinian. You'd like, it
yeah,
was
yeah,
just,
yeah.
You, no one could actually have a majority. That was the best part. No one could say, me and this guy, we're the same and we don't like you. And it was like, because everybody was just completely.
So everyone's mixed. Got a mix from somewhere else that gives you that connection somewhere down the chain.
But the thing was, we talked about it earlier when we were hanging out upstairs, is that, you know, you sometimes have to really look for the good in people, right?
Yeah.
Especially kids can be a little bit vicious and shit.
Yeah, yeah.
But it wasn't racially vicious. It was just like, if you try to be a tough guy, someone would check you. And a lot of times I did some checking and I got checked a couple of times.
Yeah.
You just learn, you know, and that's how it is. And that's how it was. And I think that was the good part about it, where we're talking about interpersonal dispute resolution.
Yeah.
Like, I was good at that from a young age, man.
It's interesting you saying how at the time you'll kind of see it as all good, and it's upon reflection you see that certain things weren't great. And I think it's weird. There's certain places that have that as a survival technique almost. And I think in the UK, Newcastle is my favourite example of that. There's some rough areas in Newcastle, but everyone I know from Newcastle is just like, yeah, it's fine, it's cool. Because you just got to get on with it. If you're in that, It's kind of a bit of a modern certain parts of London thing to be aware of what's wrong and moan about it and complain about it. Whereas it's far more a Newcastle and New York type thing of, yeah, there's shit wrong, but we got to get on still. It's kind of the same. This is an odd comparison, but people say how it's only in Western culture that we have things like depression and stuff like that. Because in the
and
jungle,
vacations.
That's it. In the jungle, you've not got time for depression.
You've
got to walk. Like for us, and it is still bad. But the story of someone having to walk 2 miles to get water is heartbreaking. To someone who's only known that's like, that's what I've got to do.
Yeah.
I'm going to go and get that water. I'm not going to cry the whole way there and cry the whole way back because I have to do this shit every
day. I'm not going to fucking Insta the water once I get it.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not going to take a picture of me smiling and shit in my water.
Yeah, so it feels like that's something that New York has. It's got its problems, but it's... And similar to London in that way, as we've seen with the recent terror attack. Like, we're recording this end of March.
Yeah.
That thing that, and we saw it in France as well, that when there was terror attacks, everyone went, right, no, we got this. We're not going to be broken. We're not going to be scared. We're going to come together and get on with it. And New York has that feel as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, I was living in Manhattan on 18th Street and 8th Avenue on 9/11, right?
Shit,
and I had a brownstone. I went up to the roof and I was watching. I couldn't really see exactly all the way downtown because I wasn't in a really tall building.
Yeah.
But I saw the fighter planes flying around Manhattan after the fact, and I was like, shit.
And it's going down.
Well, I mean, it is one of those things that's multi-layered, right?
Yeah.
Especially the New York thing was, God knows what's going on with that.
Yeah.
I'd rather not talk about that because it does bug me, man.
Completely.
But I think what's important for people to understand is that, you know, you can always say you reap what you sow. And yes, Western civilization has done a lot of bad shit to a certain part of the world that is now manifesting in terrorist attacks and stuff.
100%.
I'm just saying that's what's happening.
Yeah.
And I think just life in the city can't be denoted. It can't be defined by that type of shit.
Yeah.
Because if you did, that means we'd be like, you know, I can't ride a skateboard in New York. Why not? Because when I was a little kid, someone took my skateboard. It's like you can't live your life like that.
100%. And as I said, it's an interesting one. And again, we won't get too deeply into it because this is a friendly conversation podcast. This isn't a political debate. But it is that thing that is something I was considering the other day that people will say about, and again, this last one, it was a British guy who'd been brainwashed. And that's horrible. It's brainwashed for evil for this. But you've also got to at some point go, why are we so easy to brainwash against? It's going to mean there's some good there's some good shit that you can say. Look what they've done here. Well, look what they've done there. Do you know what I mean? It's trying to not be blind to we are the wonderful innocent good guys. It's like, it wouldn't be easy to brainwash us or brainwash against us if we didn't have some shit in our past and some shit in our locker.
You can always judge. I don't know who said it, but you can always kind of judge the moral compass of a civilization by looking at its art.
Yeah.
Right? And that's a real... someone told me that a long fucking time ago. And it's something I always thought about when I was thinking about what's going on around me, especially with culture. When I was writing music with the Criminals, when we were very, very popular, so I was writing like my second and third record where I was knowing that like millions of people would hear this shit. It was like you could start almost taking a little bit more responsibility of what you see. And this was kind of a thing I used to think about. And... you know, like starting in 96 when we did our first record, it was before really the internet, social media kind of thing, but it was still in that weird postmodernist thing I was telling you a little bit about where, you know, it was starting to get lowest common denominator and really overtly vulgar for the sake of it. And, you know, that's kind of like when you realize, well, if we're not really caring what we're putting in our hearts.
Yeah.
We're not really caring in any respect.
Yeah, yeah. Completely, it's weird. I mean, it must have been a strange, or it's strange when any band blows up. But it must.
For us, we were like, "What the fuck did we do wrong?"
And again, and when you're doing it, when you're making music, with your friends, particularly in New York, particularly as fun-loving criminals, you're going to be kind of playing up to shit, playing up to characteristics, and suddenly that's blown up, and that's you.
But we got lucky because in America, for the most part, I mean, the first record, it did go gold in the U.S. and stuff like that. And we toured with U2, but it wasn't
it grew up in the U.K. a lot more first,
right? Yeah, big time, in Europe and Asia and stuff.
Yeah.
So we could go back to New York after the second, third, fourth, whatever record, and we were still virtually anonymous.
Yeah.
You know, it was just kind of like the guys who knew were friends of us. And maybe the places we hung out. I was talking about Bungalow 8 before. They had a drink with my name was a drink.
Yeah.
So it was like you get away with certain shit being anonymous. But for the most part, only English tourists would be like, "Yo, shit, you're Huey, right?"
Yeah.
I'm like, "Yeah." Like, what the fuck are you doing here? I was like, "I run this shit, motherfucker.
This is my spot."
But yeah, but that was great though, because then you could still have the real conversations with people about, you know, if you write stories like I write stories, that's the idea with your song. You want the actual human condition explored. You're not answering questions. You're just letting people know that they're not alone in the feelings they're feeling, right?
Completely.
So that's what I was trying to do, and I was able to do it because we didn't blow up in America, and that was great. But it was also one of those things where I knew that when I got off a plane in the UK or in Japan or whatever, I could get away with some shit I couldn't get away with in New York.
It's a beautiful situation, right? It's a parallel to living out in the countryside.
Yeah, in that
when you go home, you've got a bit of privacy, and then you can choose, I'm going to go and be Huey.
Yeah,
I'm going to go and be a fun-loving criminal in the UK, in Asia, or wherever else, and have that buzz and excitement of being a rock and roll star as such. And
I mean, I did do it for a long time. I'm not really looking for that buzz too much anymore other than playing music.
Yeah.
But you know what? The farmers out in Somerset, they don't give a damn.
Yeah.
They're like, that dude used to be a Marine, I heard. Oh, yeah, whatever, leave him alone. He's got a shotgun. Which I don't have. I don't have a shotgun.
But they probably do. So, you know, it's kind of, it's the balance,
That. I got, like, you know, all these mounted machine guns in my property.
But
yeah, don't fuck with an ex-military person's house. That's all I got to say.
Completely. So what was the route into the Marines? It's something that, obviously, you're... anyone who's been in that situation is very proud of. Mm. Was it? Is it something that you look at as it was a good thing? It was the right time because you joined quite young, right? Yeah. I've got a guy coming on the podcast in a few weeks who is a campaigner for pushing up the age of military service because he joined the army in the UK at 16,
yeah.
And he went through some shit, man. And it was, again, he felt it was the right choice at the time, but it was a similar thing. He felt a little bit brainwashed, and he still got the utmost respect for all of this, but it was a strange time.
When I went in, I was young enough that my mother had to sign a parental consent.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And at that point, I was, like I said, like ODB. We're talking about ODB's lyrics.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I sound like I had a couple open cases, but nothing specific.
You know what I'm saying? Right. Yeah,
where's
yeah.
that from? Pop Shots?
Yeah,
Pop Shots?
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, nothing specific. But like a kid that age shouldn't have shit like that going on.
Yeah.
And I think it all boiled down to me thinking I was a tough guy.
Yeah.
And
it's that thing at the younger ages as well where you can... it is all going to be that bit less specific.
Yeah.
You're not at that age where it's easy to put... Do you know what I mean? It's that thing you can get away with shit, so...
To a certain extent, yeah, but, you know... But also, I think I was lucky in the respect... I mean, I'm saying I'm lucky that I got out of it, I should say. Big picture, I'm lucky I lived, right? Because I know a lot of my good friends hadn't, and a lot of my good friends got out, and they were a lot more fucked up than I am. So I can't say that, you know... I was lucky to know somebody who knew that maybe I needed this kind of structure.
Yeah.
I did, and, you know, it was suggested that, you know, I enlist.
Yeah.
I was like, you know what? These guys think they're fucking tough with the fucking Marines over there. Let me give that a shot. And, like, at that age, we were talking before, when you're that young, you're still wild, man.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm a dad, and I know that having a son, they're wild from the fucking getty up. It's our job to kind of, like, channel that.
To rein it in, to nurture it in the right places.
And just know that they can feed other things with that fuel. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? With that fire that's going on, it's good, but you have to, you know, you can do other things with it rather than break shit.
100%.
But, yeah, so I was in young. I did really good because that's what I was channeling it to.
Yeah.
And they're really good at showing you what you can... Because, you know, we're essentially, like, just big crazy apes with guns and booze.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how we got to look at ourselves. And if anything brilliant comes out of humanity, we got to cherish that shit.
Yeah. You know?
Essentially, we are fucking monkeys, bro.
Yeah.
And I think that kind of like, we get, that's lost.
Yeah.
So I think, anyway, but getting into the service that young, and especially the Marine Corps, it was an experience that I think I needed at that point in my life, right? And, you know, it served me really well. Since I lived through it, it's like one of those things, don't kill you, it makes you stronger. That's essentially true.
Yeah.
Because I know guys that, you know, I know guys that it almost did kill.
Yeah.
And it didn't. And those are the toughest fucking guys I've ever met.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So in the same respect, coming out of it the other end in one piece is a massive deal and a massive achievement as well. So what was your route? Because I remember hearing at the time, and again, I bought the Grave and the Consonant single when it came out. So before the album, I was down from day one.
Tipping my toe into my subconscious, man.
Yeah. But I remember hearing then that you worked in a bar and you were just playing in house. So how did you get from the Marines to working in a bar? Like, what was that?
A lot of near misses.
Yeah,
you know, we were talking about that before. Yeah. It is kind of, if you can. I mean, if you know me, when I was young, I used to love music.
Yeah,
I always could tell you who was playing bass and drums on an old Stax record. I knew the guys. For some reason, my mother had gotten me the Encyclopedia of Rock and Roll.
Yeah,
and it was the bathroom book for me. And it was just me and my mom in the house. And, you know, like, the little boy goes in the bathroom. He's got a book. It was that book.
That's amazing.
I just learned all this shit really young. So I was always into music, and I also started playing guitar when I was probably about 10 or 11.
Yeah,
because chicks dug it, right?
Yeah,
and
then
I started playing blues
because
this kid in my building who's a little bit older than me had, like, really good music, like Robert Fripp and 801 Live and shit, which is some trippy shit you get into. But anyway, like rock and roll and stuff like that. So I started playing music. So it was like something I really thought was a big part of my life. A lot of kids, especially in my situation, I was an only child. And when you're starting to go through stuff where you don't really have a father around, you start looking to other things and other older dudes to kind of show you the way. And that's rock dudes, rappers or whatever it was, man. So rapper was starting a little bit later on in my life. But like rock dudes, like, oh man, you know, this dude looks cool, let me see what's up with that. And you'd learn different types of music, like Muddy Waters, that's a cool motherfucker, I want to be like him, you know, I wish he was my dad, you know. So that was kind of how I did shit.
And a lot of that's a bit of luck in who you stumble upon and who's there to influence you.
I'm glad, like, my mother had
some
Ray
blues
Charles
guy
record,
about the road and stuff like that is kind of it pushes you in an amazing direction that you can lose yourself in.
And that's why the Fun Loving Criminals wear suits, because the old blues dudes, especially Muddy Waters.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, he wears a suit because he has respect for what he does, you know?
Yeah.
And that was kind of the thought behind it. And then, you know, when I was starting to hit the streets, you know, it was at a time where, like you said, you could get away with a lot more.
Yeah.
There wasn't, like, you know, there wasn't NCIS and fucking, you know, all these people running around with forensic kits and shit. You get away with a lot, man. And it was open season in New York, man. Quote old DB again.
Yeah.
Like, the Brooklyn had the hardest projects, and when crack came in the neighborhood, it started popping. So it was like that type of thing in New York City was real easy to be bad.
Yeah.
It was real easy to, but you weren't really bad. You were just doing bad shit and making bad money.
And at
that young of an age, I got into some fucking trouble, and I turned out I had to go to the Marines to get my head right.
Yeah.
So when I got out, it was almost as if I think about the only good times in my life before the Marine Corps, it wasn't slinging and hustling and being a jerk. It was the music. So I said, oh, well, you know, I got a job at a nightclub because I didn't want to wake up early ever again. I was like, fuck that. Because all you do is wake up early in the fucking Marines. They're like, can I lie in today? No.
I've learned that. I know how to wake up early. Let's move on to learning some other stuff now. I've got that nailed.
Okay, you need to learn how to shoot. Now you're good at that. But so I got this job at a nightclub, and that's where I met Fast.
Yeah.
This dude we knew in... This guy we both knew, mutual friend, said, you guys would get along, man. Shit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And we did.
Yeah.
And that's kind of how it all started.
I had Billy Bragg on the podcast, and he was saying how he kind of got his break where he'd be the go-to guy at a local music venue if either a band pulled out or he'd be there supporting. And that was kind of his in. The fact was, he wasn't about, I want to be paid this much, or I want a headline, I want this. He's like, I want stage time.
Yeah.
And that
you
was a similar
time,
thing with you guys, right?
Absolutely.
It was just kind of when there was a gap to get up, you'd be getting up.
Initially, this girl, Andra, who was a club kid, you know, with the crazy platform sneakers and like the little, like, I don't know, Alice in Wonderland dress, crazy bugged out hair and shit.
Yeah.
I used to love that. I didn't find it like girls that were club, because I didn't really find them sexy, because I thought it was kind of like almost like comical, but they were funny, man. Them bitches were crazy, man. And I say bitches with all the love in my heart, all right?
Sure, yeah, definitely.
And the thing with that was, this chick had a birthday and was like, knew me and Fast, and was like, yo, you motherfuckers need to play my birthday party. And we're like, we're working that night. She goes, I'll talk to the manager. She talked to the manager. Manager comes up to us like, you guys aren't a band? We're like, yeah. So we did the gig. He liked it. And then whenever a band canceled the opening spot, or if nothing really big canceled, but we'd open up for like Sugar Hill Gang and Korn, you know?
Damn,
and like just like Cypress Hill. I mean, we did all these crazy gigs because we were there. So if they didn't have an opening band, and the headliner's like, we're not going at 9:30, we're going on at 11:30. Oh, we need another band.
Yeah.
You guys punch out, get your shit, come back.
That's the perfect situation.
We're forced to rock big because the Limelight and the Palladium, that's like 2,000 people, 2,500 people in a big joint. You're like, fuck, you gotta know what works real quick, because you're an opening band, bro.
Did that variation of support slots and whatnot influence your style? Because just as saying that, it's just all of those bands you listed, it fits, because you've got some blues, you've got some rock and roll, there's some singing, there's some rapping, there's, you know what I mean, it's all there. So you'd think you wouldn't see this, like if you were going to see the Sugar Hill Gang and then later that week you're going to see Korn, you wouldn't expect to see the same support act. Yeah. But
and Bruce Hornsby, we opened up for Bruce Hornsby.
Again.
So like that kind of shit, it made us realize that we liked all types of different music.
Yeah.
And we knew, like, if we're doing a half hour before Sugar Hill Gang, make it interesting for the people who have come to see the Sugar Hill Gang. You know that. And being a guy that worked, I was like the bar back for a minute at the disco bar, which is the main room at the Limelight.
Yeah.
I'd see bands every fucking day at work.
Yeah.
So I knew what worked. I knew that what things you could say to a crowd in between songs that they'd under fucking stand. Because a lot of dudes get up there and go,
you need to keep it short.
Exactly, man.
You need to allow them to get some response in to get out of their system, because they're going to give a response.
Oh, yeah,
so if you don't want it, then it's going to fuck shit up.
If you're going to like mumble down the mic at a club gig, right?
Yeah.
I'm saying? You got to, you know, keep it short, concise. But, you know, things like that, you just learn, and it becomes, I guess it becomes part of your process when you go out on stage.
Yeah.
Because you're like, I'm going to do what I'm going to do, but I know what worked and what I saw work and what I saw that maybe I could interpret. You know what I mean? Because you don't want to, you know, kind of just mimic folk where you see them.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're like, all right, well, that fucking worked. And like, there's just small things like how you talk to people or just small things about like how you don't point your big fucking amp out, point it sideways so it doesn't burn the people in the front row. Shit like that.
And again, I think people seem to bizarrely get ashamed of taking influence. I think that's a positive thing you need to learn from people.
People think, I think a lot of times people want to think they're unique.
Yeah.
Right?
And
that's cool. You could be unique, but you're not growing up in a vacuum. I mean, look at Prince.
Still learn from what people are doing, right?
Prince, absolutely unique guy, right?
Yeah.
But he learned how to play guitar by watching Hendrix and shit. Yeah. You know, he learned how to dance by watching James Brown, right?
And he learned how to have a house band from the old soul and funk band so they can go, right, let's go off on a tangent. It's all those influences. In my mind, you wear them with a badge, right? You should wear them proudly rather than be secretive
back,
of this
right,
shit.
Back in the day on your backpack or your jean jacket, you had your freaking influences. You wore them
Here's
on your
bands.
Sleeve, right?
Yeah.
You defined yourself through the music you listened to. And I remember that was like, I'm older than you, right? So I'm 48. But when I was coming up, it was like disco sucks or rock. You know, it was the rock disco thing.
Complete rivalries.
But it only happened outside my neighborhood, because in our neighborhood it was both, and then there was salsa, and then there was like you know Planet Rock was coming out too, so it was like the whole thing was like we loved everything. So there were like metalheads. Like I remember these two kids, I think they were like Panamanian, like Central American kids that were like straight up gangster metalheads.
Yeah,
and like in Mexico and Central America, metal is like Sepultura kind of metal too.
Yeah, definitely.
And there were these two kids that like were Albanian. They were brothers, the Lika brothers. So these two heavy metal Peruvian kids and these two heavy metal Albanian kids, those are the four guys I learned how to play guitar with.
Amazing.
So I was learning how to play blues guitar, and they were like, that's so slow. You have to learn how to sweep pick, which is like this technique where you go bleep, bleep, bleep.
Yeah.
It's insane. I don't do it. But like, that's who I played with. So I learned all that metal shit. And I just thought it was great that you could hang out and listen to that. And then they go like, hey, that Pointer Sisters song that Nile Rodgers, but Thinking of You.
Yeah.
Like they were learning that intro and the guitar. Yeah, ding, 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 and they were cool with that too. So it was inclusive. I thought it was cool.
I think that's it. It's taking all the good bits. I think in the UK at least, for years, I'd go to rap gigs, and that'd be the most underwhelming gigs I went to. I'd go to punk gigs or metal gigs or anything else, and that'd be wild. So as a performer myself, it was like, right, I don't have to just take influence from the rappers I've seen, because a lot of them are just standing there, and in reality, they're kings of the studio, not necessarily kings of the stage.
That's absolutely right.
I want to be a king of the stage as well. So it was that kind of a looking at Springsteen and Prince and people like that, who couldn't be further from what my music is.
Mm-hmm.
Or Billy Bragg, I've already mentioned, we got to support Billy one time quite early on, and he picked us. And it was great to see his crowd kind of be like, they've not got any guitars, this is weird. And by the end of the set, they kind of got it, because we were talking about politics and all sorts of other shit and trying to put on a show. I think at that point, it would have been hard for a lot of rap acts to get over to a Billy Bragg crowd.
Yeah.
But again, and the other thing
Do you think it's because you listen to all this different stuff that you kind of realize that, especially with like that like tribal music thing,
where
I guess like Billy Bragg is like indie, right?
Yeah, really thoughtful indie. Yeah.
That certain people nowadays listen to stuff that is exactly like their Facebook run, where it's just like everything that they agree with doesn't make them uncomfortable at all. Because when we were growing up, and the same thing with you, you check this other shit out, you wouldn't fucking listen to, you know, Tunnel of Love by Springsteen on your headphones, but you're like, brother did his shit on that stage. And it just seems like nowadays people wouldn't look out of their lane.
Yeah.
You know, they wouldn't even look up, man.
It's a weird one, man, because we've got the internet now as well, so it's so much easier to look out of your lane.
Just watch some other guy play it. You know?
My musical tastes expanded so much when I worked in a record store. Because other than that, I can only afford to buy one or two records a month. I ain't taking experiments. I ain't checking as something out. I'm getting that one thing. But it had that openness and availability to be in the stock room and go, let's listen to this.
You don't have to buy it.
That was
I knew a guy who worked in a record store, and that would be my dude. It was placed on 2nd Avenue in St. Mark's. He was the dude that put me on to the first Clash record.
Yeah, yeah,
you just
yeah.
say, look at this cover. I go, they look like some badass motherfuckers. They are. I was the record good? It's awesome. So I was like, all yeah. right, here's my weekly $8 yeah, yeah, or whatever yeah, yeah. I fucking got from my mom yeah. for taking garbage out and shit. But yeah, no one really took a chance, I think, to a certain extent, unless they heard something before.
Yeah.
I mean, now it's so much... I think it's just all the paradigm is not even... It hasn't shifted. It just fell off the flat earth. And yeah. now there's something new there. It's like trying to equate like the Kitty Hawk, which is like the first airplane, to the space shuttle. I mean,
yeah.
they have something in common, but then again, 99% of it is not in common.
It's
so,
different.
Yeah.
Creatures, they're both flying... Yeah. But they're flying in completely different
yeah,
places.
Yeah, totally
it's not relevant. The other thing I liked from what you were saying there is, particularly in those early days of doing opening slots and wanting to impress the crowd. I think
the
difference
girls,
between
not even crowd girls because yeah, yeah. if the girls are happy, the guys are happy.
Yeah,
and that's
100%.
And that's when I DJ clubs, man. It's like I'm not playing songs for you, dude.
Yeah,
no offense, playing songs for the girl that you're with because when she starts dancing, you smile.
You're
because your
that.
Girl
yeah.
is dancing. You know,
I love that. I love that. And again, it's getting across. It feels like it's
we're monkeys,
and it may
man.
Be
we're monkeys with guns and alcohol, bro.
Completely. It may be oversimplifying or putting into boxes, but it feels like the difference between bands and performers who come from a working class background and you're more art school type thing. And yeah. I've seen bands who go up there and they're there to perform their art. And whilst I've always had an element of that, I'm there, like I feel almost guilty. People have paid to, yeah. for a night out. If I'm getting up there yeah, and not making the move, then shit, I've fucked up in some way. And that yeah. it's that kind of, I think it's that attitude and outlook that...
Yeah, you're right.
That pushes you to perform well.
Yeah, you're right, man. I know that there are people, it's like, you know, everybody has, you know, I just say I'll break it down to 360 degrees of their self, right?
Yeah.
And especially when you're trying to actually make a go of being artistic and being productive at the same time in your life and you get a job like we have.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a certain responsibility that falls on a certain type of person.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
And I think you're right.
Yeah.
I think it comes from the person who actually had to think of it as more of a thing than an expression. Like,
right,
you know,
yeah.
like when I first got our record deal, I was like, shit, this is my thing now.
Yeah.
I got to learn how to play guitar better. I was good. I knew how to play. I didn't practice.
Yeah.
So I learned how to play guitar better because that was my thing.
Yeah.
All right. Now, if it's my expression, man, whatever I do is cool because I'm just expressing myself.
Yeah.
Like the band The Strokes. A lot of people like them. I think they got good songs and all that yep. stuff. But that's the one band that the dudes in the band never got any better
yeah.
at playing their instruments.
It's genuinely the band I was thinking of when I was saying that some people just get up there and do things. And again, I'm a massive fan
no,
of The
I'm
Strokes.
They do
I've
what they do well, but
yeah.
they didn't. We're talking about evolution.
Yeah,
there was
yeah.
no involvement in their thing because it wasn't their thing. It was their expression.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
and like, you know, when we're talking about girls liking stuff, yeah, you know, girls like The Strokes for that kind of laissez-faire attitude
yeah, yeah,
of their
yeah,
shit.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
girls also like motherfuckers who know what the fuck is up at every moment.
Yeah,
and that's
yeah.
that's the dichotomy. And then most people lie in between, you
yeah.
know? So if you are on either side of that spectrum, it's a good thing. You
yeah.
know?
So what was it like then when you started, or when you suddenly found yourselves in the music industry? You're not in a band anymore. You're in the music industry. You're working with labels and managers, yeah. and there's all sorts of pressure to release records, to tour.
Well, you know,
how did you find that? Because again, hearing the upbringing and the Marines almost being there to get you in line, but from what you've said, it felt more like you were going there to say, I'll show you I can do that. Do you know what I mean? More motivation than I need to get in line. So how was that to
my
be
stress,
in that world?
I'll tell you, my stress management has always been really off the mark. I was
yeah.
always good at not letting things get to me.
Yeah.
Right? Especially when we got this record deal. I
yeah.
realized that, well, the whole thing was, the record deal was unique in the respect that they offered us an 8 record deal.
Damn.
So 8 albums, they were like, we want you to be here. Like, they're pretty much saying, for your career, we want you to be on this label.
That's crazy. And that came about from someone being in the crowd,
yeah.
right?
We never did a demo tape, but this dude who was a DJ at the club, this guy Dominic.
Yeah.
Dom was like, yo, yeah, give me Dominic DeLuca, fucking guy. He was like, you know, give me something I can play at the club. You know, he plays rock and hip-hop,
yeah.
one of the things. And he's like, give me something I can play at the club. So we went in the studio and recorded the shit that we were playing live
yeah.
and gave him the tape. And he was a scout for EMI.
Right.
We didn't know that. He was trying to get some shit because he thought
yeah,
we were good.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he got a founder's fee. So he was motivated by these, man. He was
yeah.
like, I'm going to make some money. He brought it to this dude, Mike Schnapp, who was the head of A&R at EMI.
Yeah.
And Mike Schnapp came and saw us a couple times, but didn't tell us. And then brought his boss, who was the president, down. And then we played this one gig that wasn't tremendous, but it was a good gig. And he came backstage and offered us this deal. So it was like...
It's crazy. And I love the shit that's going on without you knowing. Yeah, like, without that pressure. It's like, oh, I've seen you once.
Yeah.
In his mind, our relationship's developed. I'm bringing my boss down next time. In your mind... I'm playing a gig. I got a shift tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's like I got to punch out after this shit and go back and carry beer bottles. So
that's crazy.
So when you hear the story after the fact, you could see maybe there'd been trepidation on our part. But when we got the deal, I knew that this probably wasn't going to go anywhere.
Yeah.
So I was like, well, you know what? I was like being all Tony Montana. I got my word. And, my word and my balls, and I don't beg for no one. That's how I kind of rolled with it. And, when we started dealing with the label, and we knew it was an 8-record deal, and I remember my boy Fast being like, I was like, don't let it affect you.
Yeah.
Just don't let it affect you. Once it affects you, it owns you.
Yeah.
And that's what you don't want. And we had seen people that were, we had opened up for them, we'd seen people get affected.
Yeah.
And you don't want to get affected. So we tried to do shit our way. And I remember they asked us who we wanted to produce the record. We were like this guy, Bob Power, who did Tribe Called Quest and stuff.
Damn, yeah.
Because they just had the boom bap. And we knew that we were playing music like rock and soul. And if we had that low end and those drums solid, that's kind of the idea we wanted.
Yeah.
And we sent him that demo that we gave Dominic a year before, 6 months before. And he came back and had a meeting with us and said, you don't need a producer, you need an engineer. And that's how we met Tim Latham.
I was talking about, right? Yeah.
So that's how we started making the record. In front of everybody, he said that. So the whole board's like, well... They're producing their records now. So we have an 8-record deal that we're producing, a major label debut. Everything could go wrong, right? So we went down to the studio and we recorded everything in 5 days because we thought they'd change their mind. It was too good to be true. It was just not happening.
Let's get it on record. Let's get it on two-inch tape, it's happened now.
Get it on the tape, man. and take that tape out of there. And that's how it kind of got going. And we held out for the things that we thought we kind of needed to have because we knew it was temporary or we thought it was temporary. It turned out not being. But
it's
one thing. Like if I'm gonna get fucked, I'm gonna be comfortable.
Yeah,
that's the whole idea.
It's that perfect outlook of going, I'm gonna make the most of this while I can, and that will then, if you can keep that almost throughout your whole career, then you're always just you're going all in. You're going right. This is probably any minute now they're gonna go, what the fuck did we do? How do we let these people in?
You have to leave now.
Exactly.
All right, that's cool. We'll leave when they ask us to leave. But until then, we're going to have a good time. And do it the right way, too. And, what we didn't know, unbeknownst to us, is that we were those types of people that appreciated, didn't get affected, treated everybody like human beings.
Yeah.
And I think that's, to a large extent, why I'm still able to do stuff with that band 20 years after the fact. Even down to people like... who work for us as crew, or even the fans that we meet. Everybody gets the respect because they're human beings.
I think that's
important too. Everybody wants to talk about respect, especially in the rap game. Respect this, respect that. But respect is something that's a little more human than a lot of people portray it to be.
Yeah.
And I think with that comes just a certain upbringing where you're polite to somebody. Why? Because that's just the way you were brought up. Or they could knock you the fuck out too, man. It could go either way.
Yeah, I was talking to a friend of mine who's a, in fact, I won't say who it was in case it's in any way slanderous, but they were talking about how they'd worked with a massive film star at some point. They were going, he's the nicest guy in the world to everyone, but you know that it's for a reason, and it's to get this and to do that. And my response to that was, if you're going to be contrived and calculated, if you can be it in a way that means you're nice to everyone, that's kind of dope, right? There's no loss there. I can't get mad at that.
Yeah, and also, who's to say that he's maybe compelled to do it for reasons that you don't understand?
Yeah.
That's the thing. Everybody assumes they know what everybody else is thinking because that's what they'd think.
Yeah.
We're all different.
The fact is, you can get to a level of power and you can be a piece of shit to people because you're that person, or you can go, I'm going to be nice to everyone.
The $10 million rule. That's what we call it. In New York, we call it the $10 million rule.
Yeah.
You make $10 million, you are who you are. You don't give a fuck about retirement. You don't give a fuck about having a job for the rest of your life.
Yeah, go fuck yourself, money.
You become who you are. And I've seen that fuck a lot of people up to the point where they don't have the $10 million anymore. They're just like assholes and everybody knows they're assholes. Man. And I know people that were always the good guy and always like the stand-up guy about shit. And if you get a certain amount of money, Yeah, I mean, it does allow you, if you have gripes that you want to get back at humanity.
Yeah.
People do that, man, and people sometimes are bastards.
The thing that I like, and again, it came from the
fuck off kind of money. Fuck off. What? Yeah. Fuck off. My name's Harvey Weinstein. Fuck off.
Exactly. You've got that. The thing that I liked, and from the first time we met, I got it that exactly that. You've always been polite and friendly and cordial, but also I know that you're still a dude from New York, and you can, you know, if someone's trying to walk over you, then you're not going to stand for that. So there's two things I've noted that I want to discuss, and one of them is, I think it was the last time we saw each other, I got you to tell me the story, because I'd half read it or half heard it years ago about doing a gig or a festival somewhere and Hanson were playing and the little kids.
Yeah, it was the MTV Awards, man.
MTV Awards. I remember hearing that back in the day, and then the way you kind of told it to me was even better than the way I'd heard it. So
we were backstage at the MTV Awards, but it was in like Rotterdam. It was in Holland. Mm. It was in because we were smoking a lot of grass.
Yeah, you know,
and it was okay. I remember that.
It was allowed.
Yeah, well, it's pretty much allowed. It's like Keith Richards. I was hanging out with him one time because he only lets me interview him at the BBC. He's like, I want Huey. And I'm like, I don't know him, but I'll hang out with him. When I interviewed him the first time, I asked him three questions. I was like, what are you reading? Tell me about the blues. And, yo, I'm a dad. Can I be a better dad? And that's the three questions. So he likes me. Thinks I'm all right. I didn't ask him who he's fucking or whatever. So I think it comes down to, wait, I think I just spaced that. I lost my train of thought.
You're backstage at the MTV Awards.
I dropped Keith's name and I lost it. But it just comes down to, he said he could smoke anywhere because he's Keith Richards.
Yeah,
so we felt the same thing with the pot. We've done it over the years. It was kind of stupid most of the time. But
and you've been known. It's in the songs.
I prefer that than booze.
If someone has booked you guys, there's going to be a suggestion that this might be
happening. Yeah. But, you know, as the older we get, we kind of have tapered that. But was the point of it was like we're smoking outside this dressing room that Fast was dating this girl who was presenting an award, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And he's in there with her, so I go outside because that's his girl. I don't want to be in the dressing room with them. So I light up with Jimmy. I'm hanging out in the dressing room, and this little kid comes out, and it's the kid who's now like 6'5", big old football player from Hanson, who was the little drummer kid, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. He might have been like 11 or 12 or whatever the fuck he was. He was little, right? He's like, you need to put that out. I was like, no. Why? He's like, he starts getting really heated on me. I was like, yo, fuck off, kid. You know, don't come at me like that. I don't know you. You know, like, I'm not mean to him on purpose, but he's coming at me very aggressively. And I'm looking around like, whose fucking kid is this, man?
Yeah,
don't clock that he's the dude in Hanson yet, right?
Just some
obnoxious kid. I think he's like the son of somebody. I'm like, hope it's not the dude Tom who runs MTV. He's like, this is my boy.
Yeah.
Just told my boy to fuck out of here. So I'm just like, yo, just off, man, you know. And he comes back, goes in this room, comes back out with this dude who's like, you know, his dad, the kid's dad. And I was like, he's like, who told my kid to fuck off? I was like, I didn't tell him to fuck off. He came at me telling me all about myself. I'm a grown-up. He's not a grown-up.
You can't talk
right?
to me like that. Now, yeah.
And I go, send your son away. He was like, huh? I was like, send your son away. The kid went back in the room. I was like, it's on you now, motherfucker. You came out here talking all this shit, and I'm not going to hit you in front of your boy, but yo. He was just like, and then the kid was sticking his head out, and I go, I might hit you. And he was like, ah. And I went in there. But yeah, it was just like me being overly aggressive, man.
I love it. And it's just the kids from Hanson.
Yeah, I mean, it turned out
to talk up to grown-ups.
Yeah. But yo, man, they had a weird upbringing, man.
Yeah,
so
completely. Again, I always thought
it was okay
that
to talk to an adult they didn't know who was doing something illegal.
It's not wise. But again, you can forgive that stuff. If you've had this weird upbringing. It's always been my thing with when people go on about how Justin Bieber's this piece of shit and whatever else. I was like, it seems like he is, but you don't. He's not had any. He's never lived in reality. Yeah. It's like he's gonna be in some way.
Yeah, it's the
hopefully,
Michael Jackson shit. Man.
Yeah, hopefully he'll come out the other end, and it all makes sense. But you're gonna have a period where you're crazy.
There was that one video I saw of Justin Bieber like in England, London. Trying to kick some shit to some dude, your fucking ass or something like that. I was like, wow, you must be jet lagged.
Yeah.
But I mean, like a lot of young people are like that though, man.
So I do want to talk about.
They haven't knocked the fuck out. Like, like I was telling you, like, you sometimes.
To get punched in the face. Yeah, know it, how that
but
feels.
Also, you realize that you're not going to die if you get punched in the face, but it's not fun.
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
It's not enjoyable
it's
in any way.
It's not something you want to keep doing, so yeah. Maybe you just reel that mouth in or wind your neck in. Is that
yeah.
what they say in
English? Yeah, 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 completely. But equally, it means that when you are talking shit, you know the consequences. Oh, yeah. It means something to you. I'm talking shit. I know what the consequence is, but this means enough for me in this situation.
Yeah, this ain't Twitter, dude.
I mean, I want to talk about Six Music because that's been like a life for you. But one of the other things I want to get into, I've always felt that in this industry, you can spend too much time thinking, is this the right choice? Is this the right choice? What will people think of this? What will people think of that? And I try and look at any project I'm presented with and go, does that look like I'll enjoy it?
Yeah.
Is that something I want to do rather than career-wise? And I thought exactly that when I was on tour once, and it's one of those hotel mornings, I've just turned the TV on, and I saw you and Lisa Tarbuck presenting a show about rescue dogs, and I was like, this is not what I expected to see Huey on early morning, but it was great. Again, I love dogs. Again, my exact thought process was, I'd love to do a show like that. It's like,
well, I was talking about opportunity, right?
Yeah.
And like, I come from low expectations, frankly.
Yeah, yeah.
So where I come from, like, you know, taking a field trip to Staten Island was something I wanted to do.
Yeah.
I probably would never have gone to Staten Island otherwise. So when that came about, I love dogs. I had just buried my dog of 17 years.
Yeah.
This dog, Sugar, she was all the way through my life, right?
Yeah.
Well, 17 years of it, right? But my adult life.
Yeah.
And I thought I wanted to give back because, having that dog kept me out of trouble. I couldn't stay out all night.
Yeah.
Hanging out with bitches. Yeah. Fucking getting in trouble. Yeah, I was like, nah, this can't happen. I got to walk my dog. I don't want to shit in my room, you know?
100%.
When I come home, I don't want my apartment soiled. So I wanted to give back, and this is a perfect opportunity to do that. Some charity work, that's great. You do
that.
But it comes down to even something more simple than that. I didn't know if I'd like to do that or not. I had never hosted a fucking rescue dog show before in my life. Maybe that would be something that I'd fucking find great joy in.
How do you know until you do it, right?
Exactly. Like I did something, what was it, BBC Breakfast or something like that, and Louise Redknapp does
it. Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I don't know her from back in the day. I did that. It didn't work out for me. I'm a little too vulgar for that.
Right, right.
Actually, you know what? Not vulgar. I'm just a little too hip for that, really, frankly.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because, you know, I could see how it's very middle of the road, white bread kind of thing. And, like, not 100%. To disparage that, but just that's not me. You know? So I didn't know that until I tried it. And the same thing with working with Lisa was great because I can play rhythm guitar, and I realized that I can play rhythm guitar.
Yeah.
So that's something I learned from that.
This guy, it was her show.
She called me up, was like, yo, we've done a radio show together.
Yeah.
A couple times because I think Jonathan Ross had gotten in trouble for that Russell Brand
shit. Right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
So he was out, and they got us to do a couple weekends.
Yeah.
And she's cool. I like her. She's a sincerely awesome chick, right?
She cracks me up.
Yeah, she's cool, great. Man. And she's smart as fuck, man. So she called me up and said, yo, I need someone to play rhythm guitar in this shit. You know, it's like eight shows, we can do it in like a week and a half or something over at television. So I was like, fine, yeah,
let's do it.
And I did it. I realized that, wow, that's what it's like to make that kind of show on a big network.
Yeah,
there was so much crazy shit that I did. It was like making a film. It was like that, like straight up. So yeah, it was interesting to do, but it's like not something I'd go out of my way to try to do again unless the opportunity presented itself where it made sense for me.
But again, you've learned that, and it's similar, and we'll get onto radio now. Like when I had my radio show, I had to have my arm twisted so badly to do a radio show.
Likewise.
And the thing that was sold to me on it was, it's going to be playing hip-hop that hasn't got a home in this country.
Yeah.
It's going to be playing people like Sage Francis or Rhyme Sayers or Strange Famous and all these other kind of labels that don't have a home over here. So I was like, all right, well, again, in a way, I was like, I'll do a good deed. I'll do this show. And then I fell in love with it. I fell in love with broadcasting. So was that a similar route to you? Because
almost,
it seems like such
almost
a perfect
got a word
fit.
For word, because it's almost been 10 years since I've been working at Six Music, right?
Yeah.
And I've been at Radio 2 like 7 years.
Yeah.
Right? So it's really weird to think about, wow, I've been doing that a fucking long time.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do it at first. And it's kind of interesting. When I got hired to do the Six Music stuff, the thing that got me to do it was, I wasn't in love with music anymore.
Right.
Whatever had happened with the band, and, you know, there was some rough parts with the band because we had a big problem with our manager, and it took me like a lot of years out of it, lawsuits and crazy shit.
Yeah, of course.
And I just was out of love with music. Yeah. And I still had this fucking amazing record collection, right? I got like 250,000 records, man.
Yeah.
But you know, now it's about that, but it's all digitized now.
Because I lost
a whole mess of stuff in Hurricane Sandy. I had a storage locker with
literally
like, you know, about 15,000 LPs and maybe 5,000. You know, shit got wrecked.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I luckily digitized a lot of shit. Now you can have like 15 hard drives and a bunch of shit. You don't even listen to it anymore.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, that's how I got back into music, and I knew I needed something.
Yeah.
And as much as like I thought that, I don't know if I was like I could club DJ, because I always did that. You know, you always got to spin some records together. But being a radio DJ was different. So I just kind of went in there and just played music that I knew I liked. And I realized through that process, I was back in love with music. And a lot of people that listen to my show find it eclectic, which is a nice word to say, scatterbrained or whatever. But that was me growing up. So, you know, a lot of us are like that. A lot of us like different types of shit.
Yeah.
And I realized that I had a lot of kindred spirits in the world, because a lot of times you think you're alone in your tastes 100%. For a lot of things, but music in particular, especially young people and things. And you realize it's okay because other people feel the same way about music. It kind of makes you feel like you're part of the equation, you're part of the human race.
Yeah.
And that's important, especially for a dude like me who always felt he was a little bit outside shit and was always trying to get in with certain things. And, you know, especially when... You know, when you try to actually assimilate into society after you're in the military, it's the hardest fucking thing to do.
Right.
And, like, especially now with a lot of the young kids who actually have spent the last 15 years at war in America, and even in the UK, there's a lot of dudes that are homeless and things. They can't compute and things. I find it really helpful to know that you're part of the equation.
Yeah.
And that's why I talk to veterans groups and shit like that. If I can, if they let me. Because a lot of times they're like, you're a little wild with the motherfucker stuff. And I was like, motherfuckers know what I'm talking about. But it's true. All vets are like, they say motherfucker to their mom.
Yeah.
I'm like, this motherfucker. Yeah. But with that said, though, I think it's cool to fall back into something that, like, in my life gave me purpose.
Yeah.
Which is back when I was a really young kid and music was the thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it helped me do a lot of things with the world.
It can be fear of things that aren't real hurdles that put you off jumping into anything like that. And I can imagine with the BBC, for example, because they're so known. And again, they with stuff like the Russell Brand thing and all that. Yeah. There's so many rules and regulations. But you realise that once you're in there and you become part of that family. Then there is give and take, and there is that trust. And it was similar. It's weird. Like when I got my XFM show, in the meeting I had, I mentioned you and Zane Lowe, because particularly at that point, there was such weird rivalries. Like, it's what I love about podcasts, is there doesn't seem to be. I'll talk about podcasts I love. And the thing I said in my meeting was, look, I'm up for doing this, but as long as I'm allowed to say, if I'm playing a track I heard on Huey's show, that I heard this track on Huey's show. If I heard a track on Zane's show, I can say I heard it on Zane's show. It doesn't have to be this illusion.
You wanted integrity?
Yeah, that's it. I wanted that illusion that you have to pretend that every track you've selected it appeared on your desk out of nowhere. It's like, no, you... Again, it's credit for influences and stuff like that, as we were discussing earlier with Live.
I think, like we said, there's certain types of people that have a certain outlook on things like that, you know, because the way you're brought up.
Yeah.
And you give people props. I remember I spoke to Zane... Yeah, I'm like, about 10 years ago. Yeah. Now, Zane, we all know, is at Beats now. He took the money. Everybody's like, oh, he took the money. I was like, you know what? You don't know his situation.
Yeah.
You know, he's a fucking righteous dude, for real.
Yeah, 100%.
And he should be compensated to be that righteous dude to someone who really wants to hook him up. Also, you know, he's from New Zealand. Right now he lives in L.A. That's a short trip for his parents to make to see their grandkids. So he's doing fine. And also, that's his business.
And people don't credit Zane enough for the amount he managed to push the BBC,
because
when he started,
he
pushed a lot musically, but when he started doing his like an hour long interview with Kanye and an hour long interview with Eminem and stuff like that shit wasn't about, particularly with radio, it was soundbites, a short little thing, and he kind of said, no, this is something I can do, and I can easily see how there's going to be a big wave of money with Beats and stuff like that, but equally he can go, I can go somewhere else and see where I can take things and how far I can push stuff and what I can do, rather than seeing it as it's taking the money and run. It's like,
but, I mean, a lot of people in England feel kind of upset that he left the BBC because he was doing shit like that.
Yeah,
and you know, within the BBC, there's not a lot of revolutionary spirit, right? Yeah. Not everybody's dressed like the Gallagher brothers and with the shelter suits and wave their arms around the hallways. Yeah. It's not like that.
Yeah.
Like, people are pretty much middle of the road, people trying to do the best they can, but they're not like the I'm going to try to put this the right way. They're not people that commonly go out on a ledge and do stuff very different, right? It's something 100%. That, when that happens and it's done well, like Zane did those hour-long interviews, you came out of that going,
damn.
Yeah, you're going, I have a good understanding of who this person is now.
Yeah.
And that's something that's very rare, especially in a generation of sound bites and three-second joints. Yeah. It's hard to do. So when I was speaking to him, that was kind of when I was like, how do you manage to do the stuff that you do within this kind of framework of the BBC? And not like it's a bad thing, but it's just, it's existing.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you can't just go in there and start moving buildings out of the way.
It's existing, and it's existed for a long time.
Yeah, for a reason, for a good reason. It tries its best to be an impartial conduit of culture and art to the British people.
Yeah,
all right.
Yeah.
For whatever that is now, that's their, I think, their remit or their charter, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So they try to do that. And, you know, a lot of people there are very fucking smart, you know, I mean, and they know that they may need someone like Zane Lowe, or they may need someone like me.
Yeah.
And it's okay to need someone like me to kind of play different shit. But also at the same time, I'm that type of person that was raised that certain way. So there will be that naturally. And to their credit, from the beginning, they've just said, just do what you want to do. And if we have a problem, we'll let you know.
Yeah.
And they have let me know on certain occasions. They were like, we have a problem with that. I was like, okay, I'll stop doing that.
Again, it's that outlook of, and it's something I had on said on the XFM show, that our outlook was, look. And again, it's something that isn't particularly BBC, but when they find the right person, they'll allow that. That kind of, let's ask for forgiveness rather than permission.
Yeah.
So let's just do it, and we'll see what happens. And then if it doesn't work, if something's not right, cool, then we can address that. But rather than overthinking, everyone's going to get offended at this every little bit.
Well, everybody gets offended at everything anyway, so you just got to be hopefully, you know,
and they're allowed
to. You're true to yourself.
And you're allowed to offend.
Yeah, and you're allowed to be offended and not cry in a corner. I mean, that's the thing I find a lot nowadays. It's like people get really offended at stuff, but it's always the wrong people. Like, for instance, every once in a while, I don't go and curse a lot on the radio because I know kids are listening with their parents and stuff. So I'm trying to be respectful to the human being that might be listening to the show.
Yeah.
Not because I don't fucking curse. I curse all the time.
Yeah.
But I know it's okay in certain ways, and it's not okay with the BBC. So every once
in a while...
You're
going to love having a podcast. It's fucking great. Go on.
But every once in a while, I'll slip up, right? And I remember one time I was like, wow, that record still kicks you in the dick, right? And I was like, whoa, I'm really sorry. I was just really enthusiastic, and that's what I said. So as far as the BBC is concerned, if you say, wow, generally, dude said he was sorry, man, I guess he's sorry, they're cool with that, right?
Yeah, yeah.
But someone will get offended saying, he just said kick him in the dick, right? And that's a bad thing, right?
Yeah.
I can understand that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I come from a neighborhood we were talking about before that was very diverse, probably the most diverse place on the planet, right? And I was taught by this Jamaican kid that I grew up with how to do a little patois thing, right?
Yeah.
You can't do that, man. Just simple shit like that, right? I was doing something on the radio about the Sleng Teng rhythm. It was celebrating like its birth or whatever. It's like birthday, right?
Yeah.
So I did like the shout outs on my show like this. You know, it just goes out to Corey Haim or whatever. Just being kind of funny with it, right? Of course, someone got offended very, very badly.
Right.
It was not a West Indian person, of course. It was someone who felt that they were offended because whatever
their... the potential of someone else.
Yeah, I mean, it's like this kind of politically correct kind of, well, you know, that's not, you don't say that. Well, I learned it from the first hand. You know, I practiced it with this dude. No, he said, you can't. So I learned it with a guy who I didn't look at as lesser or greater than me, but he was my friend.
Yeah.
And he taught me that because he cared about me. And he thought it'd be funny if Huey talked like that. Not detrimental, not disparaging. Just it would be kind of funny.
Yeah.
Like people have good times with each other.
Completely.
And it was just ironic that it was the person who was not even involved in this. I had to apologize for doing it on the air. And then, of course, every West Indian person listening was just like, dude, don't worry about that shit.
This is fine.
Don't worry about that dude. You know, it ain't us, man. And I think that's kind of like, that's the animal of what we do today when we broadcast, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, like when I said if the BBC have a problem with something, I'll stop doing it, it's because it's probably something that will bother somebody. You know, and I'm not there to bother anybody.
No, exactly.
I have my own opinions. I keep them to myself for the most part. My podcast will probably be a little different.
Yeah,
but
completely.
That's okay, though. You know, you can have an opinion. I think it's okay. And it's also okay to sometimes offend people because some people need to learn that the world isn't just what they see.
100%. I always remember seeing an interview with Stephen Fry, and he was saying it's bizarre that in this day and age people feel that them being offended is enough of a reason for you to have to change what you're doing. He was like, you're more than allowed to be offended, but that's part of life.
Yeah.
Like, we get offended at stuff. It doesn't mean I have to change what I'm doing, and and so on and so forth.
You know that expression, what would Jesus do?
Yeah.
We have one in New York. What would the Bronx do?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So if you're playing your music too loud and someone gets offended, what would the Bronx do? If someone says, hey, you need to turn your fucking music down, man, that's offending to me. What would the Bronx do?
I love it.
Would tell you to fucking eat a bowl of dick. All right.
I love it.
That's what the Bronx would do. And that's, if you do that, you're not being an asshole. You're being like, you know, come on, man.
Yeah.
You know, don't pipe up if you're not really ready to take this to the next level.
you see, this is perfect. I'm going to wrap things up as we're at the hour mark, but there's two more things I wanted to get in, and this leads into one perfectly. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go again to kind of, it sounds like I'm making it about myself, but I was at home one day, and I'm looking on what's on TV, and you get excited like when your boys are on TV.
Oh, yeah,
you
know, on TV. You got out of the hood, man. Let's see what's up.
And I look, and I'm excited. I see, oh, Huey's on this show. I know Huey. Uh-huh. Oh, so's the guys from the Rizzle Kicks. I know the guys from the Rizzle Kicks. Oh, so man. I'm hyped and excited, and then it's Buzzcocks, and shit did not go down well. And again, my instant thought was, it is what it is, but my instant thought was, dude, do they know that Huey, you know, he'll be thinking, what would the Bronx do? You know, is that exact example?
Well, yeah, what would the Bronx do? But, yeah, I mean, you just don't, I should never be on TV with you know what, we didn't mention it before, but when I came out of the Marines, I was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress.
Right.
But not to a debilitating point. And I know a lot of people don't know that about me. And
right, sure.
I've been struggling with that for a long time to be able to kind of keep things together in a real banal situation like a television talk show.
Especially when
you know that it's not that important, right?
Yeah.
And then you realize that everybody else thinks that's the most important thing you've ever done.
Yeah.
It just kind of trivializes the idea behind it. And
I was
put in a situation where I was there for a long time. And, you know...
And longer than people who... would imagine, like having done a few little TV shows and things and realizing how much it's retakes and re-angles.
But
and
also
that.
At the same time, I did say, yo, I'm going to smash this cup for an edit point. All right,
yeah.
me and Phil knew this was going to fucking happen.
Yeah,
because
I had
hosted that show too.
Yeah.
So I'd done it like 7 or 8 times. And the ironic thing is that after the fact, you know, they asked me to do some hosting on that show. And eventually I said, nah, I don't think so, guys.
I don't think it's going to work.
But, you know, that show used to be crazy. I remember Mark Lamar, he was the one that hooked me up with my Radio 2 show.
Yeah.
He was the dude who was like, yo, he's got a good record collection.
Yeah.
And so they're like, all right, because I took over from him at Radio 2, 12 to 3. But, yeah, so it was one of those things where it used to be a lot worse, and just goes to show how really weird things are today when if anybody steps out of the line, and like we used to be getting fucked up at that show back in the day.
I mean,
you know, it's weird if someone throws a mug or you know.
It's seen as this big story or this big thing.
And essentially, you know, I think everybody's kind of lost their shit at one point or another, right?
Yeah.
Happens to everybody.
Yeah.
All right?
Completely.
Happened to me.
100%.
All right? I think that was a good one because no one got hurt. I didn't hurt myself. And that's the thing. Sometimes, most of the time, if I get in a situation like that where it all seems a little bit too much, and I get a little bit weird, I usually end up hurting myself.
Yeah.
So I'm glad no one got hurt.
Again, I think, again, it's another a weird thing in society that we feel that every time there's a reaction, it's a negative thing. And I don't think that's the case. Again, like I've had a lot of people on here talking about depression and all sorts of other things. Mm-hmm. And I always say you should get help and all this and we should address it more. Now, personally, I don't feel I've ever been depressed.
Mm-hmm.
I've been really sad, but because some bad shit's happened. And to me, that's an appropriate reaction.
Yeah.
So again, if something's pushed your buttons and you've got angry, no one's got hurt.
Yeah.
There's been a reaction. That's okay. That shouldn't be a big drama thing. There should be reactions to things.
I mean, we spend how many millions of pounds and dollars to level our emotions out with like Prozac and things like that. It, you know, the human being is supposed to have a varied emotional spectrum.
Wide range. Yeah,
that's the idea of being human. If you
100%.
Don't, yeah. So I mean, without getting too far into it,
yeah.
I mean. Having known that you have a stress disorder and knowing that certain things can get you to a certain point, you avoid those things. But at the same time, it's like a pack you carry with you all the time. That pack's never going to get any lighter.
Yeah.
The only thing a person can do is be brave enough to look in the pack and just arrange shit that doesn't dig into your back when you put it back on.
That's amazing.
It's the simple thing. I learned that from a guy who was a Marine as well, who taught me a lot how to handle what I handle.
Yeah.
And, you know, without, like I said, without getting too far into it, that's the brave thing to do.
Yeah.
Right. And I don't give a fuck what people think of me anyway.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Imagine what my family and my friends think of me. And they all tell me what I don't want to hear all the time.
Yeah.
So it's
yeah.
not like I'm getting off scot free.
That's the people you need to know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, it's the people you need that. It's the people that you care about, their opinion of you and your own opinion yeah. of yourself. But stuff like that, I mean, it's kind of funny that, I mean, a lot of people bring that up, and it's like, I don't get, the only thing I feel a little bad about is that I think I scared the girl that was on my side of the stage.
Right, right.
Just because
right,
she freaked right, out right, when it happened. Right. And I watched it back and I saw her, she freaked out. That's what I'm, if anything, I'm a little more regretful about.
Yeah, yeah.
Breaking a cup?
No,
dude, I've done a lot more worse shit than that in my life. So.
Completely. Again, if I thought it was in any way a shameful or bad thing, I wouldn't have brought it up.
There was this magazine called Calm Magazine, which is about mental health issues.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
I did a piece with them.
I've worked with Calm a lot. Yeah. It's a lot of male suicide stuff and all that. Yeah.
Yeah, and the thing about men, us dudes, is that, you know, as I know that women have their own separate issues as far as like how they're presented, how they present themselves to the public and in society. Men have issues as well, as far as like being tough guys and things like that. And we think we need to cover up all this stuff and be ashamed if things happen not the way we want them to happen all the time. That's just life. So you have to make things okay.
Yeah.
And emotions are okay. And outbursts are okay.
Completely. I couldn't agree more. Yeah. Well, I'll wrap things up now. Tell me about the podcast. So you're going into a podcast, and it's with Acast as well. So I'm glad it's all kind of in the same family.
It's in the hood. And you know, when I was interested in doing one, and when I first started talking to them, I was like, you know, the only one I can really say that I really respect is the one you do. I mean, and it was one of the things that you had asked me to be on years ago. So I started listening to it,
and I was
listening to it more. And then the book I'd have in the bathroom,
I'd read
it and listen to it and all that stuff. So it feels like it was something that, you know, I can aspire to. So thank you for having me on and giving me the ropes and showing me what's up with stuff, man.
No, it's pleasing. But what's it? It's going to be interviewing.
The wrestling info, too, because a lot of times I don't get it all the time because I'm a dad now. I can't get in there.
You get all that info in there.
Yeah, so, Superfly Snooker dying, though, man, huh?
Yeah, that was some dark shit, man. It was weird, though, because when that happened, it also came out that he was close to being charged for some dark shit in his past and stuff like that. So it's weird how their shit spirals. But just as I said, to round things up, your podcast is going to be interviews. Right? And well, I know you've recorded one with the producer. Oh, we mentioned him earlier. Tim Latham. Engineer.
The Tim Latham's going to do one. I mean, hopefully you'll come on and do one for me.
Yeah, 100%.
But what I wanted to do is just have conversations that I'd have in my regular life. And I think it's kind of good to have those kind of conversations anyway. And if people can get something from them, that's cool too. You got to hang out with me and some other person. You know, that's
cool. What's great. I had Gemma Kearney on recently, who's done Radio 1 and loads of other stuff, and she was saying the big realization that she had was that she's been really lucky in the people that she knows and meets, and that's, although that's just her life, that's actually something of interest to other people. And it's not saying a look at me, it's more saying look at this dude I know. How crazy is his life and all the things he's worked on and this kind of thing. So
I don't think it's celebrity driven at all. I think if anything, it's like what I find interesting in my life, and I think what I can rely on it with your podcast. It's like what you are interested in is very apparent, and you can learn a lot about stuff that you would not necessarily know about, which I think is what human interaction is about. I'm on the beginning of a mission now.
Not necessarily just staying in your lane either.
You were talking about that.
The beauty of interesting conversations is it can teach you about engineering and these other things that you might have thought, I didn't know I was going to be interested in that. But
And the pretext of it all is like, maybe we should just do it in a bar all the time, right?
Yeah.
Just having just being in some club with nobody there. We'll get more than water next time, but you know.
It's perfect. Well, I love it. Well, thank you very much for taking the time, and I'm glad we got to do this. I can't wait to hear your podcast.
Well, thank you, Pip. I appreciate you having me on, bro. Thanks.
You've been listening to Scroobius Pip's Discretion Pieces.
There we go. What an absolute dude. I adore Huey. We've genuinely become really, really close over the last few years. And it's like a lot of my friendships I've made since being in the entertainment industry in some way, in that we don't get to catch up all the time, But when we do, man, there's a closeness and a warmth and a tightness. So, yeah, I've got nothing but love for Huey Morgan. Check me out next week on his podcast, Huey Off The Record, on Acast and iTunes. It launched last week and kicked off with Ricky Gervais. So, yeah, pretty solid guests on his part. And, yeah, a lot to come there. So, thank you all for tuning in. Check out all the podcasts on the Distraction Pieces Network. As ever, thank you for supporting. And I will see you next week. Ta-ta!
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.